On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin and Mr. Brian Chi here today. And, you know, we've talked about system vulnerabilities in the past on the show, but today we have the top 30 most exploited vulnerabilities list, and all of them seem to have a very similar commonality among them. We'll talk about that. Plus, the new norm is a hybrid workplace. Collaboration is critical to that success. Today we have Brad Hintze. He's the EVP of Marketing from Crestron, and he's going to take us through just how your organization can be successful with workgroup collaboration systems. Shouldn't miss it. Twyde on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyde, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 454, recorded July 30th, 2021. No more snow days. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Akamai. Akamai is the world's largest distributed edge compute platform. Deliver and protect your digital experiences worldwide. Tap into Akamai for its unrivaled intelligence, performance, and scalability. Visit akamai.com/enterprise today to learn more. And by ESET. ESET boasts ransomware protection that means business with internet security products and services backed by world-class research and tech support. Learn how to protect your business from ransomware at business.eset.com/twit. And by Endava. Subscribe and listen to Tech Reimagined, the podcast from Endava, from wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Twyde, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own enterprise and security expert. He's a senior analyst at Omdia, and he's Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing reasonably well. I'm just all in a near frenzy getting ready to head out to Las Vegas next week. You know, my virtual part of Black Hat will be on Monday. If you'd like to attend the Omdia Analyst Summit, I'll have the link in my Twitter feed. But I'll be heading out there on Tuesday, have a session live on Thursday, and then I dive into DEF CON. So it's going to be a fun, packed week, although it's going to be a week behind masks. We got word from the show organizers that due to the latest uptick in COVID cases, the entire event is going to be mandatory masks. So we're doing what we can to stay safe while we stay informed about the latest in security.
Fantastic. Sounds like a very fun, packed week. Looking forward to that. Well, speaking of unpacking, he's the guy who never sits down. He's network and security expert, and he's our very own Mr. Brian Chi Chibert. How are you doing, my friend? And how's the unpacking going?
Actually, we had a big milestone. We finally got our optical media unpacked and put into shelves. And of course, with my librarian wife, it is all in alpha order and by topic. So we can actually find things. It's kind of fun. You know, it's one step closer. I'm actually going to start wiring up the surround sound system this weekend.
Ooh, that's going to go really well with your massive wall unit there that you have. What is that, an 80 inch?
82. There's a question. You know, I was going to try and see if I could go and twist some arms at the Infocom show and see if I could get some deal on some display wall panels. I was thinking maybe a 2x2 or 3x3. But then the pandemic and no more really good deals on display models at Infocom. So the 82-inch was on sale at Costco and said, you know, maybe I don't need that much complexity in my life.
That's right. That's right. You can't pass that up for sure. Thanks, Cheaper. Thanks for being here. Well, speaking of packed, it's been quite a packed week in the enterprise. So let's get started. Now, we've talked a lot about system vulnerabilities on the show. Now, we have today the top most exploited vulnerabilities list, and all of them seem to have a similar commonality to them. We'll get into what that is. Plus, the new norm is definitely a hybrid workplace. Collaboration is critical to that success. Today, we have Brad Hintze. He's EVP of Marketing at Crestron. He's going to take us through just how your organization can successfully work in a workgroup collaboration system. But first, like we always do, let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Mobile banking, investing, and finance is convenient, don't you think? Well, it also means that you're at the mercy of whatever security measure companies take to secure identity and your assets. Unfortunately, for the Android platform, several malware has spread through the Google Play Store using a novel way to supercharge the harvesting of login credentials for more than 100 banking and cryptocurrency applications. Now, the malware, which researchers from Amsterdam-based security firm Threat Fabric are calling Vulture, is among the first Android threats to record a device screen whenever one of the targeted apps is actually open. Now, Vulture uses a real-time implementation of the VNC screen sharing application to mirror the screen of the infected device to an attacker-controlled server. Now, the typical MO for Android-based bank fraud malware is to actually superimpose a window on top of the login screen presented by a targeted app. Now, the overlays that such windows are actually called appears identical to the user interface of the banking app, giving victims the impression they're actually entering their credentials into a trusted piece of software. Now, attackers then harvest the credentials, enter them in the app running on a different device, and withdraw their money. Unfortunately, banking threats on the mobile platform are no longer only based on that well-known overlay attack, but are evolving into rat-like malware, inheriting useful tricks like detecting foreground applications to start screen recording. This brings the threat to a whole nother level, as such features open the door for on-device fraud, circumventing detection based on phishing MOs that require fraud to be performed from another device. Now, Vulture, like many Android banking Trojans, relies heavily on accessibility services built on the mobile OS, essentially detecting user input and performing automation. Now, the malware is installed by a Trojanized app known as a dropper. So far, Threat Fabric researchers have found two Trojanized apps in the Google Play Store that install Vulture. They found installations approaching 5,000, leading the researchers to estimate that the number of Vulture infections is actually numbered in the thousands. Now, unlike most Android malware, which relies on third-party droppers, Vulture actually uses a custom dropper that has been called Brunhilde. Now, while Google has removed all Play Market apps known to contain Brunhilde code, the company's track record suggests that the new Trojanized apps will probably reappear. Now, what should you do to actually protect yourself here? Well, you should only install apps that provide useful services, and even then, only apps from well-known publishers, as well as apps that are signed in a good place. And also, make sure that they've been out for a while, they've been released for a while. You should also pay close attention to user ratings and app behavior for indications on possible malice. Or you could just use your financial institution website.
Is the government going to ban ransomware payments? It's not very likely. Well, on July 27th, Brian Vondran, assistant director of the FBI's cyber division, told lawmakers on the U.S. Senate Committee on the Judiciary that the agency does not recommend companies pay ransom because it doesn't guarantee the business will regain access to their data or prevent data from ultimately being leaked. However, Vondran also stressed that banning ransomware payments is not the way to go. Companies should always have the option, he said. If you ban ransom payments, now you're putting U.S. companies in a position of another extortion, which is being blackmailed for paying the ransom and not sharing that information with authorities, Vondran told the Senate committee. It's a really complicated conversation, he said, but it's our opinion that banning ransomware payments is not the road to go down. Ransomware attacks have cost U.S. and Western European companies billions of dollars over the past few years, with more than half of attacks related to ransomware and the average ransom growing by 171% in 2020. The problem has become so bad that some insurance firms will no longer pay ransoms to bail out affected companies. The concerns come as governments search for solutions to the plague of attacks coming from cybercriminals who see U.S. and Western European companies as cash cows to milk with crypto ransomware and cyber extortion. The FBI and other Department of Justice officials did make the case for mandating the reporting of ransomware attacks and other breaches. Quote, because far too many ransomware incidents go unreported and because silence benefits ransomware actors the most, we wholeheartedly believe a federal standard is needed to mandate the reporting of certain cyber incidents, including most ransomware incidents, end quote. Borndrand stated this in written testimony and included, unlike other types of cybercrimes, the victim will almost always know when a ransomware incident has occurred. The scope and severity of this threat has reached the point where we can no longer rely on voluntary reports alone to learn about incidents.
Well, a bipartisan infrastructure deal will provide $65 billion, that's a billion with a B, for broadband deployment and require ISPs that receive funding, quote, to offer a low-cost, affordable plan, unquote, according to the White House the other day. President Joe Biden pledged early in his term to lower internet prices, and this appears to be the first tangible result. Although it would only affect ISPs that take the new funding, and the White House didn't release key details about the affordability of the internet plans. A White House fact sheet on this $550 billion infrastructure deal with senators included two paragraphs summarizing the broadband portions. That is, more than 30 million Americans live in areas where there is no broadband infrastructure that provides minimally acceptable speeds, a particular problem in rural communities throughout the country. The deal's $65 billion investment ensures that every American has access to reliable high-speed internet, with a historic investment in broadband infrastructure deployment, just as the federal government made a historic effort to provide electricity to every American nearly 100 years ago. The bill will also help lower prices for internet service by requiring funding recipients to offer a low-cost, affordable plan, by creating price transparency and helping families comparison shop, and by boosting competition in areas where existing providers aren't providing adequate service. It will also help close the digital divide by passing the Digital Equity Act, ending digital redlining and creating a permanent program to help more low-income households access the internet. So the catch is, this only affects the ISPs that take the money and doesn't define what affordable costs or acceptable speeds are. So only time will tell whether he's actually doing something or is just a paper tiger.
So I want to take a moment to talk a little about microservices. Now, microservices emerged 10 years ago as, you know, that one of the examples of the convergent evolution that sometimes happens in software. Now, while that term can be credited to James Lewis and Martin Fowler at ThoughtWorks, the global software consultants, similar ideas are being discussed by Adrian Cockcroft then at Netflix and other Silicon Valley firms. Now, in the decades since the term was coined, we've seen a large rise in things like Kubernetes, service mesh, and the beginnings of serverless. And we're starting to see the influence of microservices being applied to the front end as well. Now, alongside horizontal scaling practices, more microservices allow developers to deploy code more rapidly, favoring the replaceability of components over that maintainability. Now, there are now a wide variety of mature, well-known design microservice frameworks that cover the basics here, especially the basic languages, with a plethora of options that are out there. Now, a couple of the other initiatives are regarding Kubernetes are worth tracking, but jointly created by Microsoft and Alibaba Cloud, the Office or Open Application Model, OAM, is a specification for describing applications that separate the application definition from the operational details of the cluster. Now, the question is, how will Microsoft services actually evolve over the coming years? Well, one possibility, at least for enterprise customers where performance concerns tend to not be that acute, is that the service mesh gets pushed deeper into the platform and largely being hidden from developers. Now, more work could be done to actually reduce the networking overhead introduced by service mesh itself. Another possibility here is, though, is that it may actually be a shift to a different runtime altogether. That could actually happen as function as a service. We've talked a lot about that, which is essentially what we call serverless. And that can ultimately replace Kubernetes as a de facto standard runtime for distributed applications, less to manage and better pricing due to the cost of compute only. Now, another area that remains challenging has to be the overall system architecture and the related issues around the team organization and structure. Now, I've talked a lot about in the past domain-driven design. It's a cornerstone of some of the microservice movement that's out there, and it's something that should be considered by any software architect. However, even regular developers like myself here need to have some understanding of how the scope of entities and boundaries and a lot, which comes back to API design, which is actually hits home for me. Now, anytime an architecture stands the test of time, our architecture itself stands the test of time in an ever-changing environment, it provides hints into the solutions and its evolutions as its requirements become more complex. If you haven't already, it may be time for you and your organization to familiarize yourself with scalable and secure microservices design and implementation. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Akamai. Now, when you are in software and services like I am, you think scale, and you definitely always think Akamai. Now, I've been using Akamai for many, many years, utilizing their unparalleled CDN support for scaling and requiring low latency. But, you know, we've also talked a lot about microservices on the show and how organizations choose that. And imagine not having to think about scale for those services. Edge computing brings your software and services to close proximity to those, to your end users. And that's where Akamai is the platinum standard here. Akamai is the world's largest distributed edge compute platform. Now ask yourself something. Would you like to deliver extraordinary customer experiences and run code at the edge? Well, Akamai is your answer and is truly powerful. Why would you use them? Well, because Akamai has 10 times the locations of the nearest competitor. That's over 4,000 locations. You're always closer to your end user with Akamai, significantly cutting down latency. Now, Akamai will also greatly improve your customer experience as well. Your customers will get the content, apps, sites, and video they need without lag, interruption, or latency during unexpected traffic spikes. Prepare for spikes in demand and optimize resources to provide the best experience for your customers. You'll be amazed at Akamai's unparalleled performance, and you'll always be one network hop away from 85% of the world's internet users. What about scalability? Well, application architects get the flexibility to scale their enterprise applications with Akamai's Edge Workers. Now, with Edge Workers, development teams can focus on building while letting Akamai take care of the challenges of scaling globally. And because Akamai empowers you to deploy serverless code at the edge, so you won't experience the headaches of increased traffic at origin or the overheads that go along with it. Now, Akamai gives you the power to innovate right at the edge because your logic and functions are deployed and active at the nearest proximity to your end users. You're getting the fastest end user experience around the globe. Akamai makes it simple to build right at the edge using JavaScript so you can innovate in real time. You get low latency access to data from custom code at the edge, and Akamai can optimize your API traffic delivery for edge applications. But what's the cost? Well, even with its unrivaled intelligence, performance, and scalability, Akamai is comparatively priced. Because limits are set per request, you can be sure your workload will scale no matter the size of your user base. And being serverless means you'll see decreased overhead at the origin too. You know, Akamai and their reputation, they're trusted by the biggest brands in the world, and you're getting 10 times the locations of competitors for the fastest customer experience available. So check out Akamai website to learn more about edge computing, even have a conversation with them directly. You might be surprised by just how competitive the price is. Build closer to your end user with Akamai, the world's largest distributed edge compute platform. Visit akamai.com/enterprise today to learn more. That's akamai.com/enterprise. And we thank Akamai for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, it probably wouldn't be surprising to our audience here or our hosts if I told you that the top 30 most exploited vulnerabilities list given by the feds, that's right, are basically the same ones that haven't been updated for a long time. Now, in a joint advisory, the US FBI and Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, the Australian Cybersecurity Center, and the UK's National Cybersecurity Center listed the top 30 most exploited vulnerabilities. Now, the vulnerabilities reside in the host of devices or software marketed by the likes of Citrix, Pulse Secure, Microsoft, and Fortinet. Now, four of the most targeted vulnerabilities last year resided in VPNs. Surprising? Well, the cloud-based services and other devices that allow people to actually remotely access their employers' networks, well, there's vulnerabilities in there. But despite the explosion in the number of work-from-home employees driven by the pandemic, many VPN devices remained unpatched. That's right. That's why most of these are still out there. It's pretty scary. Now, some of the top security flaws that are still prevalent are listed here as well. For instance, remote code execution bug in Citrix's application delivery controller, which customers use to perform load balancing of inbound traffic. Pulse Secure remote execution, which allows attackers to remotely read sensitive files stored by the Pulse Secure Pulse Connect Secure VPN. Another path traversal weakness in VPNs made by Fortinet. And plus a code execution vulnerability in the Big IP advanced delivery controller made by F5. Now, the vulnerabilities, all of which have received patches from the vendors already, have provided the opening vector for an untold number of serious intrusions that are out there right now. For instance, according to an advisory that the U.S. government issued in April, hackers working from the Russian government routinely exploited the Fortinet's weakness, Pulse's arbitrary file reading weakness, and Citrix's vulnerabilities as well. Now, I want to bring my co-host back in because I'm curious to see if this is surprising to them that the top 30 is basically just things that are unpatched. But, Curtis, I want to throw this to you first. Now, in my line of business, I've found organizations are notorious for dragging their feet on updates. What do you think is driving the inability or willingness to stay up to date here?
You know, I think it's a couple of things. But first and foremost is bad software development practices. And I want to bounce back to you at some point on this one, because there are far too many cases where I have heard an IT administrator say that they would love to update, love to keep patched, but that every time they try to patch, every time they try to update, it breaks a critical enterprise application that has been written to take advantage of certain very particular version-specific features of an operating system. You know, years ago, we saw this sort of thing with a couple of notorious versions of Microsoft Explorer, where you had to use, I think it was IE6, or nothing would work. And that went on for a long time, even after Microsoft had released IE 7, 8, 9. I don't understand why developers decide that the only way to gain performance is to make use of super secret features that are only available for a short time, when we know that developing to standards is the way to keep things as forward-looking and as future-proof as possible. Now, the other reason that companies are going to hate to patch and update is the cost of doing so. I mean, in most cases, it does have a real human resources cost to go through, and especially if you've got something that is a workstation update, make sure that every corporate workstation is updated. This is why automation is so critical for vulnerability management and mitigation. So you got these two things working together, and you know, just for spice, you can throw in basic human laziness. But Lou, I want to get to your opinion on this. You've certainly known developers who said, "Oh, I found this great new undocumented piece of code in a particular version of an operating system. I'll use that and it will save, you know, two clock cycles every hour on my application." Is this genuinely a good and, you know, best practice for development? Or is this people trying to be cuter than they should in generating their code?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely bad practice. I think any type of a documented or especially undocumented, unsupported APIs, they're always at risk that they're going to be changed on you, or they could potentially be vulnerable later on down the road. And I do know that some organizations out there that have implemented, whether it's on Mac OS, Windows, or Linux, implemented undocumented APIs to, like you said, either circumvent some of the services that are out there or perform an operation that's not readily available in a public API, or, you know, for performance reasons. And I think that it's a bad practice in general, only because they're undocumented for a reason. That's number one. Number two, most likely won't be supported and could be changed under the covers. And number three, that you don't want to risk the fact that these things change and make your software vulnerable because of them. So I think it's a really bad practice to do that. Now, if there's something missing, especially from an operating system, it's missing for a reason. And so going in and approaching the OS companies, whether it's Microsoft or Apple, or your brand of Linux out there, why is it missing is really the important question. I do want to throw this over to Cheever, because that was a really good question, Curtis. And I think the biggest thing here is to pay attention to what's actually supported going forward. But in the same sense, you also have to make sure that you're staying up to date. If there's a failure out there. Now, Cheever, in the past, you've worked with lots of networking organizations where they even find a challenge to keep the devices up to date. And that's, what is that, an operational problem? Or is that just in general, again, like Curtis said, maybe it's just a laziness thing?
See, it's one of those things where you look at it and you look at it and you say, no, say it ain't so. An awful lot of companies, whether it's they're too cheap, they're trying to cut back, or I don't know what, you know, justify it whichever way you want. They are not providing security patches on firmware updates unless you have a maintenance contract. Now, there are a lot of people, a lot of companies, so this is not the whole industry, where you can still get critical updates. You just can't get feature updates. So, like, for instance, I like calling out Sonicwell. I've done a lot of work with them. You can always get security updates. Anytime a critical security vulnerability shows up for a Sonicwell, those firmware updates are always free, whether you have a contract or not. You can't get the new fancy-dancy features unless you're on maintenance contract. Now, this is something that happens a lot. Now, one of the things that has been coming up more and more is lots and lots and lots of people from all over the world have been asking me, well, Cheebert, you're using a Sonicwell, but I can't afford one. What other options are there? And while the open source firewalls in the early days were kind of so-so, pfSense has gotten pretty darn good, and there's two companies that have done a very, very nice job of implementing their firewalls almost completely on open source software, and that's Firewalla and the other folks is Netgate. Both of those have been advertising free upgrades for the pfSense portion, which is the security portion. And some of the features get updated for free also, but obviously they need to make some money. So the advanced features are saying, no, you need a contract. So that's the other side of the coin. There are some people that would love to upgrade, but they can't. I need money from you before I'm going to let you have more of my updates. And I'm not sure if I like that or not. There's a lot of different things, but you know, I'm going to throw this back at Kurt, because updates as a service, is that really something the industry should be adopting? You know, I think security updates should be free, but yeah, I do agree. You got to make some money. Feature updates, you know, charge for those. Kurt, what's your view from the C-suite on that?
Well, I think that you're exactly right. Feature updates, feel free to charge for them. Make them part of maintenance contracts, do whatever you need to. But when it comes to patching around vulnerabilities, those should be free. The idea that you're going to make someone pay a regular fee just to, frankly, escape the consequences of your error in introducing a vulnerability, that doesn't make sense to me. And I would be happy to hold any vendor's feet to the fire for doing that. Now, like I said, you want to make a feature update, you want to enhance the productivity or the quality of a product, feel free to make that part of your maintenance contract, or feel free to charge for especially point updates. But if you are patching a vulnerability, if what you're putting out addresses a CVE, then that ought to be part of your responsibility to your customer community. Lou, back to you.
Thank you, Kurt. I think that's a good point. I think I wanted to ask you one more thing here, and kind of related to that. There's, you know, you talked a little bit about obviously sometimes updates, they require a lot of organization and potential operational things. We're getting teams together or potentially delivering an update to a workstation or something, and that's pretty expensive. Have you seen in the enterprise world or even IT world, a movement more towards services that essentially offer this ability, where they are scanning your network constantly and offering you more insights into what is on the network that is vulnerable and requires updates, that kind of thing? I know we've had Tim Titus on the show before and talked a little bit about some of the services they have around updating network equipment and stuff. Is that available across the board for whether it's, you know, IoT devices or workstations or network devices or even VMs and that kind of thing? Are organizations taking advantage of that?
Well, I'm going to divide your question into a couple of pieces, the OT or IoT side and the IT side. IT, we're seeing many more entries into the vulnerability management category. As a matter of fact, I've been doing some research lately into vulnerability management companies and the services that they offer. What we're seeing especially is patch management and patch automation. There are a lot of reasons for this, almost all of them having to do with the human cost of getting people to run out and apply patches, and just the operational security of knowing that every instance of a particular operating system or application has been patched to mitigate all known vulnerabilities. Now, to be honest, one thing I'll quickly mention on the IT side, this is one of the things that argues in favor of the virtual desktops, whether it's from Microsoft, VMware, or any other organization. The great thing about virtual desktops is that you can patch the one golden code copy of that, and it more or less instantly propagates across the entire user community. That by itself is enough to justify going to a virtual desktop for many organizations. I think we're going to see more doing that. Now, on the IoT side, or as we tend to call it in the enterprise, OT for operational technology, to be brutally honest, OT is its own special living hell when it comes to updates and patches, because so many already deployed devices and systems were never designed to be patched and updated. And what you have in the field tends to be this incredible array of device versions and types, with different vulnerabilities in existence and different abilities to patch them or work around them. There are some systems out there that are beginning to first scan the OT network to actually give you a real inventory of what's deployed, and then to go and look at which are patchable and which are not. What we're seeing is an awful lot of companies that end up deciding that they've got to put some sort of significant overlay on their OT network just to try and, well, to use a food analogy, put a layer of Jell-O around all of that vulnerable fruit in the middle so that they can sit there and have something that resembles a secure OT network.
Thank you, Curtis. Amazing insight there. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up is my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. But before we get to that, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's ESET. Now, for over 30 years, ESET has been a global leader in cybersecurity, and it's the provider we actually rely on here at TWIT. Now, successful ransomware attacks are in the news every day, and as a small business, we need to be protected from these attacks with a solution we can trust. Now, with nearly 2,400 U.S. companies, healthcare facilities, and more falling victim to ransomware in 2020 alone, we trust ESET to keep us from becoming just a statistic. Now, the solution's blocked advanced threats with multiple layers of protection built right in and light system footprint, so you don't even know it's there. Now, we're excited to talk to you about ESET Protect Advanced. Now, it has a ton of great things you can take advantage of right away. Let's talk about the Security Management Console and what it gives you. Now, it gives you real-time visibility of all your endpoints and plays a vital role in preventing and detecting ransomware. Plus, you can even use it on-premise or via the cloud. And with its advanced features like server security, mail security, and more, that help you sleep a little bit more sound at night knowing you're always protected. Not only does ESET care about protecting your business with solutions like ESET Secure Authentication, they offer resources especially designed for your employees to protect themselves and your company against things like ransomware, phishing, and phishing attempts. And one of these resources is actually multi-factor authentication. Now, if MFA is not already in place at your company, you want to seriously consider ESET Secure Authentication, as it is essential to preventing ransomware and other invasive attacks. Now, MFA is user-friendly for employees, and it's easy to deploy for you and your organization. It can be used with Office 365, Google Apps, and Dropbox. Now, once your employees' logins and endpoints are secured with MFA, it's time to train them for battle against online scams. Now, you've heard this stat before, that 95% of all breaches are caused by human error. So your first line of defense to make things better here is always going to be your employees. Now, ESET has made learning fun with their cybersecurity awareness training and interactive gamified training that actually teaches employees how to recognize phishing, create strong passwords, and follow best practices on the internet, all in under 90 minutes. We've been using ESET for years, and as you can see, they continue to innovate not only through their products, but educational tools that can add a vital layer of protection to your business. You're definitely going to want to check them out. Successful ransomware attacks are in the news every day. Trust ESET to keep you from becoming a statistic. Try an interactive demo of ESET Protect Advanced at business.eset.com/twit. Ransomware protection that means business. Get protected today. Learn more at business.eset.com/twit. And we thank ESET for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Brad Hinsey. He's Executive VP of Marketing of Crestron. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Now, can you take us through just a short journey through tech and what brought you to Crestron?
So I have been at a number of startups. I started way back early in my career, working on way back in the early days of Web 2.0, a development platform to build rich web applications, drag and drop, all that kind of fun stuff before Ajax, connecting it to various APIs, Salesforce, Microsoft Exchange, went on to mobile device management startups, and then made my way into commercial automation by way of smart home and residential automation from Control 4, where we were doing smart lighting, audio and video control, security, shades. And now I'm here at Crestron, where we're doing the same thing in enterprises and commercial applications.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, let's get a little bit into Crestron. I think it's an area we've touched on before here on Twilight, and it's the whole concept of collaboration. And I think what I wanted to go into first is obviously as a lot of organizations start to move back to the on-site workforce, we're still moving into that hybrid world where a lot of people are still staying remote. What are we seeing? What are you seeing organizations requiring as they move into this hybrid workplace?
Well, the genie is clearly out of the bottle with regard to hybrid. That's going to be around for a long time. You know, as companies have hired talent outside of their geography, taking advantage of the ability to do that during the pandemic, that's going to persist. And what a lot of enterprises are looking for is the ability to take those collaboration technologies throughout every single space within the enterprise. In the early days of video collaboration, audio collaboration, you could be far more selective with the rooms that you outfitted with those technologies. But now, you know, even it's no longer the board meeting or the larger company meetings that required that technology. Now it's one-on-one meetings, it's small team huddles, it's medium-sized meetings. And so you need to take audio and video control into every one of those spaces so that you can enable that quick, easy collaboration and, you know, migrate from your desk or a personal, a hot desk or something like that into this collaboration space so that you can keep working really efficiently.
So as we you touched a little bit on this, and you know, as you move into back into these spaces, now obviously organizations, they have meeting rooms, they're going to have this kind of virtual space where hybrid people will have to be able to connect, whether they work remotely or locally. How is this going to work? And one challenge I have with a lot of meetings, I have meetings with organizations all over the world, and we'll have this thing where you have presence in a, you know, collaboration space, like let's say a meeting room, but then you'll also have online presence. And the challenge here is that kind of, the collaboration that goes on in the actual meeting room sometimes gets lost to the people who are online. And how are organizations kind of getting beyond that to those types of challenges?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. Before, you know, it used to be point to point, like one conference room to another conference room. And so you didn't have the same problem. And during the pandemic, we're all on our laptops or we're all in an individual space. And so we are all equal on that same footing ground or that same footing. Now, in that scenario, a lot of businesses are, well, the team, some of the people in the room can actually be at a disadvantage from the others too, because who do I talk to, right? If you're talking to a colleague in the room, but you're both looking at the TV, it's like, where should I be looking? And so what we're seeing is a lot of questions about speaker tracking, right? Can you build some technology that has multiple cameras or some intelligence to really zoom in and keep track of who is speaking, and not just who's speaking, but who are they speaking to? I think that's one. The other is also within the room, that natural way of communicating with each other. If there's only one TV in the front of the room, and yet you've got a horseshoe shaped table and people scattered around it, you know, you've got that fight with where do I focus so I keep be inclusive. And so actually installing displays around the room so that you can look over the shoulder of somebody you're speaking to see remote participants is another one of those. And then using microphones coordinated with the intelligence in the cameras to help make sure that you're centered on the right parts of the conversation. Those are some of the things that a lot of enterprises are asking us to help them solve in this new world. Because now, you know, the old fight used to be get everybody to turn their video on. Now it's about how do we make it as efficient and collaborative as possible, because it really is deeply embedded in our world. Another aspect of that, you know, we've all gotten used to the convenience of chat. So you have the video and audio dialogue that's happening in the meeting, but you also have the chat dialogue. And in a scenario where you have hybrid, some in a room, some out, you know, how do you maintain the value that provides, while giving also the in-room employees or the in-room participants access to that, to participate, to read, to see what's going on there too. So some really interesting new challenges to solve.
Now, one thing I've seen in organizations, you walk into an organization in the past and you'll see that they tend not to pay attention to the seamless integration of all the systems. Like, for instance, whether somebody's writing on a whiteboard or whether the call is active or not, or who's present or who's not. Is that changed the need for more of a dedicated system, a system that's kind of encapsulates all areas to make sure it's all integrated?
Yeah, Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, you need to coordinate all of those things to make it work really seamlessly. Think about what things like Microsoft Teams have done for audio calls and video calls. You know, it wasn't that long ago when we were the dummies sitting in a conference room, typing in a bunch of numbers, trying to get the conference line opened up. Now it's one click to get to a meeting or get to a colleague. And so that is the expectation from employees in order to get them to use this kind of technology, but also seamlessly bridging the in-room with the external. You have to be able to see the whiteboard and all the other room technologies coming together. There are other things too, right? We're used to presence indicators on things like Teams. If somebody's in a call, somebody's available. Well, the same is true for meetings. How can you look down the meeting rooms, right? The available meeting rooms, find one that's available and jump in it really quickly or schedule it really quickly. So there are a lot of aspects related to the room technology that, you know, these new situations or scenarios that are coming up as a result of hybrid work that we really have to figure out a great way to tackle. And you know, that then goes into how do you manage all of this at scale too, right? If you only had one or two or 10 boardrooms that had video conferencing technology, now you have 1,000 rooms that require that, 1,000 rooms of devices that you need to manage. You know, that's a whole nother dimension of challenges that enterprises are faced with in terms of enabling collaboration.
So I want to ask one more question, and I'll bring my co-host back in because they're chomping at the bit here. You know, one of the things that we've seen in the kind of remote workforce is new technology has been instituted. Like you were talking a little bit about, you know, people integrating chat, you know, with kind of sharing and so on and so forth. But we're seeing a lot of essentially for the remote and the hybrid workforce, especially on site, new technologies being integrated into to the conference rooms and into the collaboration spaces. Can you maybe take us through some of the newer things that are going to be integrated? And also, we have a lot of IT audience out there, so people tend to cringe when we talk about new technology and deploying those things. So maybe take us through you know, what the challenge here is to implement some of that new stuff.
Yeah, some of the newer technologies that we're seeing are actually some of the existing things deployed in a different way, right? For instance, some things are new interfaces to be able to interact with that technology. So as you begin to get dedicated meeting rooms where you can instantly join a meeting, you need a way to start a meeting. And so you've got those touch screens that are deployed either on the table or on the wall so that you can control that meeting space. But then you can extend that and then also begin to have that be driven by occupancy sensors. So when you walk in a room, lights are turned on. Also do things like analytics around people counting and the ability to see how often that room is utilized so that you can inform real estate decisions further down the road as you decide what kinds of technologies, how many meetings room spaces do I actually need. Also things like the ability to schedule the meeting room and leave a touchscreen out in the front of the door so you can see if that room, how long that room might be available, instantly schedule it so that nobody else comes in and tries to use it and give other visual indicators so you can see from across the way which room you should be in or whether a room is free or busy. And then add to that the control of the TV and the other electronics in the room so that it is really just push one button and everything is really ready to go. And those are some of the things that, you know, some of that's been done for a long time, but pulling it together in a seamless experience, that's the new world that we're starting to get pushed into.
Right. Well, thanks, Brad. Well, we're going to come back in just a second. We do want to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and then we'll bring the co-host back in to ask some questions. Now, we want to thank Endava. Now check out season 2 of Endava's podcast, Tech Reimagined, because it's out right now. Now Tech Reimagined brings together leading tech personalities and industry experts such as Guy Kawasaki, Mary Williams, Alex Hunter, Brian McBride, Tom Gruber, Dave Coplin, Viola Llewellyn, and many, many more. Now, the podcast discusses the big questions around technology and its industries. Now, guests and hosts will be talking about these trends and how they impact our everyday lives and how our relationships with technology is constantly being reimagined. Now, check out the episodes Insurance Reimagined, Parts 1 and Parts 2, where guests Ann Norklett and Kevin Crawford discuss the role of IT plays in the insurance industry. Or two episodes about the role of AI Reimagined, Boris Sergal and Radu Orgadon talk about the regulations, accountability, and expectations that arise when using AI to solve complex problems. They discuss what the future holds for this technology and for the individuals who are using it on a daily basis. Now, interested in shopping? We'll catch Parts 1 and Parts 2 of our Shopping Experience Reimagined with guest Thomas Beechin and Jeremy Mays, where they dive into some of the most significant shifts they've seen in customer behavior over the last 12 months, including the increasing popularity of direct-to-consumer and buy online, pick up in store, and how the shift to digital is pushing people and companies to reimagine the way they shop. Now, Endava has been reimagining the relationships between technology and people. Tech Reimagined explores this relationship on a deeper level with a look at the most recent experiences with technology and its experts. Learn more about how tech is becoming so much more in this world, and that's constantly growing and changing. It's a podcast you definitely don't want to miss. Subscribe and listen to Tech Reimagined, the podcast from Endava, from wherever you get your podcast. And we thank Endava for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Brad Hinty. He's the EVP of Marketing of Crestron about collaboration and just how the hybrid workforce is going to change it. I do want to bring my co-host back in. I'm going to throw it over to you first, Hubert.
Well, I'm curious. So I'm a Crestron customer. I'll admit that. And it's been a spectacular system, and it controls a very, very nice video wall. However, it was wicked expensive to get built because I was paying for certified professionals to do the programming. So I'm curious, are you starting to see a trend where, well, I'll use the Kickstarter for Anymote as a example. There are more and more small workgroup systems that are coming out that are user set upable, I guess that's the word. Is Crestron seeing this? Is Crestron going to be embracing this for, say, the smaller work group equipment?
Yes, actually, it's been a trend in the industry to really find ways to deliver extremely great technology without all the burden of a lot of heavy, complex programming. So we have been making a lot of investment over the last several years to bring some, you know, a different approach to configuration. It's more configuration rather than programming. And so there are a number of our products that actually have had this capability extended to them. So it is much more approachable. You can bring in a lot of that technology, and it's actually across most all of our platforms now, whether it be the Flex video conferencing platform or the digital media platform to create those video walls, where you can get that configuration. Now, the, you know, whether it's done by the enterprise directly or you need to work through a channel pro, you know, that is an evolution. We have a number of products that enterprises can get through distribution and do on their own. Some still do require an enterprise pro, though it's easier for them to set up and install too, which then of course translates into lower installation bills too.
Super cool. Well, I'm seeing one more trend that's happening now that the pandemic is winding down, maybe. I'm hearing a lot of people saying, well, we're not going to want to do that half an hour, 45 minute commute anymore. I'd rather go and do a collaboration center closer to me. Are you guys seeing this, or am I just catching a few oddballs in there?
No, we're hearing a lot of that from our customers, and really, you know, where, you know, previously meeting rooms might have just been a meeting space just for ad hoc, whatever, you know, it really comes back down to, okay, if we have all this space, how can it be really purpose-built to focus on collaboration rather than just day-to-day meetings? And so a lot of people are redesigning those spaces to ensure that they have really great capabilities in order to do that. So whether that's a lot of the whiteboard technology, so you can stream to remote employees, but also just ensuring that the room works. Because if you're only coming in 1 or 2 days a week, you want to make sure everything is all up and running too, so that you can really be efficient during that time. But it is, a lot of people are stepping back and thinking about, well, how can I use technology differently to enable this different style of collaboration? But it's clear rooms aren't going away. They're just being approached in a different manner.
Thanks, Brad. I do want to bring in Curtis as well. Curtis?
Thanks so much. One of my questions involves culture. Now, we had heard a lot, say, 2.5 years ago about the disadvantage that working remotely would put employees at because they weren't there to be part of the politics and the common discussions that happen in an office. Over the last 18 months, a lot of those conversations have gone away, but now as people start to get back to the office, we're hearing them again. Do you find or do you believe that having the right quality in collaboration techniques, especially video collaboration technology, can help reduce some of the impact of the difference between in-person and in-office employees?
You know, it's a really great question. And yeah, we started the top of the segment talking about the equitable footing for everybody, whether they're hybrid or remote. Video and audio plays a real important role in doing that, particularly in those meetings where you have that mix. That's why things like speaker tracking, that's why high quality microphones so you can pick up all of the conversation, and then speakers, of course, so everybody can hear the remote attendees. It's really crucial to invest in great technology and have great meetings. We've all been in those situations where we are the remote attendee and you can't hear anything because everybody's all talking at once, and you need to invest in that proper technology so you can have a great culture and not alienate your remote attendees.
That's very good. And the other question that I have really is tangential to that, but looking at the kind of technology we have available, both from the video room and video wall all the way down to webcams and even telephone-based cameras, are you finding that people will assign different importance to meetings based on the quality of the presentation and the connection? I mean, are we getting to a point where there are going to be sort of de facto standards where if you want to do just a casual one-to-one, a particular quality is acceptable. But once you get up to, say, making client presentations or giving a presentation to the board, then you want to make sure that you're using a more formal, more pervasive kind of technology in the way we might have worn a more formal suit in the past.
Yeah, certainly. You know, some of that was true before in terms of where they invested. Now that you have video and audio in many more spaces, you will have those purpose-built deployments. Actually, we had a major customer in a couple of weeks ago, and they were exploring setting up a variety of rooms for very specific tasks, right? They were a creative enterprise. And so they had this type of meeting where writers are going through a story. And then you have this type of meeting where you have creatives that are reviewing art. And then you have this type of meeting where executives are being pitched on ideas. Each one had a different application and a different kind of installation, even though the base technology, video conferencing, kind of drove a lot of it. So the same, I believe, will be true in one-on-one, small group, and then those other more purpose-built meetings. And so people and enterprises need to approach the installation, the choice of products, and the choice of technology in a very deliberate way now, right? It's no longer, it won't suffice any longer to just simply slap a webcam in a small room. You know, you need to be far more deliberate about what type of activity you're trying to enable in there.
Thanks, Brad. We're getting a little on time, but I do want to ask one more question. I've seen some new technology, some announcements out there about the Crestron Flex phone. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, the Flex phone, it's one of those things that I think early on in the pandemic, some of us might have said, oh, we'll never have a desk phone ever again. Our laptop is perfect for that. But what I found personally, and actually there's data from Microsoft that also suggests, make it really clear that there are a lot of collaborators that want a device dedicated to the collaboration, the audio and video, whether that is to provide a better angle on the camera, better audio quality, or simply to free up their laptop to continue to be productive during the meeting. And so these desktop phones that enable you to do a one-click join for your own meeting or to call directly a colleague, you know, they're really efficient, a really effective way to stay connected across the enterprise. And we've had a really great reception to it. I think that we've all been shocked at the huge reception that we've gotten for these phones among our customers.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've set through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe. Brad, I want to thank you so much for being here. I want to give you the chance to tell the folks at home a little bit more about Crestron, where they can go to find out more and maybe how they can get started.
Yeah, the best place to get started is go to crestron.com. There you can see all of the solutions that we have for the enterprise and even for the home. We have a number of products all the way from video conferencing, unified communications, wireless presentation, but also into content and video distribution, audio distribution, even commercial lighting, and then, of course, that high-end smart home.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Brad. Well, folks, again, thank you so much for being here. You've sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe. We definitely tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes the show possible, especially to our co-hosts, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
Well, we love hearing from you. My Twitter address is ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, and I'd love to hear from you. Throw something at me. You're also welcome to throw email at me, and I'm Chebert, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T at twit.tv. But, you know, if you're going to do that, why don't you send it to Twyatt at twit.tv, and that will hit all the Twyatt hosts. Now, I've been hinting. We've got another co-host waiting in the wings. We're not quite sure where we're going to slot him in yet, but that's going to be happening. We hope you like our new host. Ought to be fun. And yes, we are going to start scheduling more host roundtables. That seems to be a pretty, I'm not going to say unanimous, but there's a lot of folks that are wanting more host roundtables talking about various technology verticals, and we'll see how that goes. But you know what? We love hearing from you. We love hearing your ideas. We love hearing your show suggestions. I will keep the list all nice and hot and keep my fountain pen ready to go.
Thank you, Chebert. Well, folks, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can people find you and all your work and what's going on for you in the coming weeks?
Well, if people want to find me in the coming weeks, next week at least, they'll find me in Las Vegas at Black Cat and DEF CON. Remind everyone that Monday is the Omdia Analyst Summit. This is a new part of Black Cat. This year it is virtual and it is free. I'll have the registration link in my Twitter feed as well as on LinkedIn and Facebook. So follow me. Please register. We'd love to have you in the Omdia Analyst Summit. The rest of the week, I'm going to be on site and lots more to come. We're going to see how the in-person conferences go for the rest of the fall, but I'm already scheduled to be back in Las Vegas in September at a conference giving three presentations, more certainly to come. And I always look forward to seeing members of the Twyatt Riot when I'm out and about in the real world.
Thank you, Curtis. Looking forward to all that. Well, folks, I want to also thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to listen to our show to get your enterprise and IT news goodness. I want to make it easy for you to get your enterprise and IT news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, and the links of the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos there you got there, those helpful subscribe and download links. You support the show, but get your video version of your choice, your audio version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices or on any one of your podcatch applications that are out there. We definitely want you to subscribe and support the show. Plus, you may have heard Club Twit. That's right. It is a members only ad free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. And it's only $7 per month. And now one of my favorite things of Club Twit is actually that exclusive access to the members only Discord channel. We have a great set of characters in there, some great features and a great discussions going on constantly out there. So you definitely want to join the movement, join the Club Twit, and be part of that movement. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit. Now, after you subscribe and you're available during the Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do this show live. That's right, live.twit.tv. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see all the behind the scenes, all the fun banter that we do during and after the show. And of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into our other chat room, our IRC chat room. It's been there for years. Great set of characters, great set of discussions in there right now. We have some great characters in there all the time. So definitely join them at irc.twit.tv. Remember, you can always subscribe to me, twitter.com/LouMM. That's my Twitter feed that I have out there. I post all my enterprise tidbits. Of course, I also have really great conversations with people like you. So definitely please subscribe and hit me up with some private message if you want to provide some show notes or some show ideas. So definitely send me some messages. Plus, if you want to do what I do, see what I do at Microsoft, you can go to developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post all the latest and greatest ways you can customize your office experience to make it more productive for you and your organization. I want to make sure I thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week, and we really couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support over the years. Of course, I also want to thank all the staffs and engineers at Twit. I really appreciate all their support, especially over the years. The show wouldn't be possible without them. Also, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chi one more time. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He is the one that does all the show bookings and the plans for the show. And again, we just really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you, Cheebert, for all your support. Now, before we sign out, we do have to thank our editor for today. He's Mr. Victor. He's, you know, he's the guy that makes us look good after the fact, removes all those mistakes and all those silly things that we do. So thank you, Victor, for all your support. Plus, we also thank our technical director for today. And he's not only the technical director, but he's also a very talented host on Twit. He's Mr. Ant Pruitt. Ant, what's going on for you the coming week over at Twit?
Well, I had a fun time talking to my friend, Mr. Don Kamareshka, also known as the mad scientist of macro photography. So go to twit.tv/hop and check out that discussion and get your learning on with some macro photography. I mean, he really, really nerds out on it.
Fantastic. Thank you, man. Definitely get your learning on. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Moresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
You may have heard about this story, but are you familiar with the story behind the story? Well, every week on Tech News Weekly, my co-host Micah Sargent and I, Jason Howell, speak to the people who are making and breaking the biggest tech news of the week. We're talking with journalists, we're talking with industry veterans, often we're talking with the people who are responsible for the story. Don't miss Tech News Weekly at twit.tv.